Hey, and welcome to another episode of the Higher Things Simulcast. A daring, highly organized Lutheran train wreck of a podcast. I am Kate Olson, and I'm here with Pastor Donovan Riley.
I'm happy. I got my root beer kombucha, and I'm peppy. I'm alive. It's good to be here.
So peppy.
Oh, there you go.
And Pastor Gillespie is here.
Yeah, what am I doing?
Doing all the important stuff.
Yeah.
We're still trying to figure that out.
Producing behind the scenes. I do want to encourage you to like follow on Facebook and Twitter and higherthings.org and like the show, send us comments, all that nonsense. And buy some coffee from Gillespie.coffee. And that'll be good.
Excellent.
Yeah. Nice plug.
Excellent. Yeah, boost my self-esteem and comment and leave questions and tell me how I'm doing. This is like, what, my fourth one, fifth one, something like that? It's exciting.
Is it? I don't know. I don't keep track. It's like you've always been here. It's all that matters.
Yeah.
Time flies.
All right.
Very good.
Yep.
That's true. It's true. Tonight, today, this morning, whenever you're listening to this, or at all times of the day and night, what are we going to talk about? What are we going to talk about? See, I miss Sandra because she asked me that question. We need Sandra here to just grunt at us.
Hey, what are we going to talk about today, Pastor Riley?
We should do a podcast on like pain and suffering, and then because you hurt your ankle, right? Did
yeah.
you break your ankle or fracture it? Like, what did you do?
I sprained it and I chipped the bone. And today I went to a doctor who told me that
what?
I did all this other stuff to it that I didn't even realize. So, yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
But I thought it would be cute or adorable or just fun to have you and Sandra on, and we could talk about pain and suffering. And then Sandra could just grunt. She could just grunt her affirmations at us. Like, like, Sandra agrees with Kate. That's a good point. Thank you, Sandra. But we're not. Instead, we're going to go the opposite direction and talk about the way to look at happiness, pleasure, and satisfaction. And the reason I bring that up is twofold, actually. One, they're kind of these big, airy ideas that kind of float around in pop culture, just kind of waiting for us to like grab them and like pump meaning into them. And so you can see what happens then if I, you know, if Kate says, you know, I just want to be happy. And it turns out that Kate's idea of happiness and my idea of happiness conflict with each other. Well, now what do we do? You know, if Kate's like, well, what makes me happy is going for long walks in the park. And what makes me happy is riding around on a four-wheeler running over Kate in the park. Like, those conflict with each other. So what are we going to do? Like, whose happiness is, like, of more value than the other person's happiness? And then it comes to pleasure and the whole question of, like, what is pleasure? What is, you know, what pleases me? And how we often confuse happiness and pleasure. And then lastly, satisfaction. And the reason I say satisfaction is the root of the word satisfaction, basically it just means to be, that it's enough, like to have enough, to be satisfied. In the Lutheran Book of Concord and the Augsburg Confession, it is enough for the unity of the church, that line in Augsburg, I think 7, yeah, our formula, or Augsburg Confession, Article 7, it's enough for the unity of the church, and that it is enough in Latin is satis est, meaning it is satisfactory, it is enough. And so what's the difference between happiness, pleasure, and saying, it's enough? And the reason I thought of this, I was listening to an interview last night, and this statistic was read out that there are more Bengal tigers owned by that are privately owned in Texas than the entire world. Let me repeat that. There are more tigers that are owned and kept as pets in Texas than anywhere in the world. Because it turns out there's no law in Texas that says you can't have a tiger that lives in your front yard. So then, there we go.
Wow.
And I thought to myself, right, and I thought to myself, you know, when the apocalypse happens, I think I'm going to go to Texas, because then you've got guns, trucks, and tigers. I mean,
tigers.
It's the greatest. So, it's like the great. That's so America.
That's so America. It's for sure. And that's very Texas, too, man. If you
can
have it, you're going to have it. And you better not have a law that says you can't have it.
If you're going to have a cat, you want a big cat, right?
Right. So come November and the election,
right?
Pastor Riley's going
buy
to
a tiger.
Texas.
I'm going to Texas. Right. But here's the thing: like, this guy bought a tiger. This is how the story actually happened. So a guy, this wealthy guy, this oil guy, buys a tiger. his neighbor, another wealthy oil guy, goes, wait, you can have a tiger? Like, you can own a tiger? Well, if he's got one, I'm buying two. So he bought two. Soon enough, there's a tiger preserve in Texas, because why have two when you can just buy an entire preserve full of Bengal tigers and just keep them as your front yard?
The next because time somebody tells you that an animal is extinct, I think you should check Texas first and
right,
see who,
exactly.
how many of these animals are owned privately. I mean, yeah, maybe there are only like two elephants in Africa right now, but there are probably like 100 in Texas.
Right. There's 36 in some guy's backyard in Texas. Absolutely. Right. He bought them for his kid's birthday party. Absolutely. But it goes to the point, because I was listening to an interview with a very wealthy man. I mean, wealthy to the point of like, he doesn't, like, if a meteor falls out of the sky and crushes his Escalade, he just shrugs his shoulders and goes and gets another Escalade. Like, that's like, he's wealthy, or like, I can't remember what the comedian was, you know, but like, the difference between wealthy and rich, I think it was Chris Rock, you know, is that Bill Gates is wealthy and LeBron James is rich. And if Bill Gates woke up one morning with LeBron James's money, he'd throw himself out a window. Because, like, Bill Gates never has to think about money, ever. Like, he never has to think about money. And so listening to this wealthy individual just talk that when he first made, you know, he had his money, he bought everything that he wanted. And then after he bought everything he wanted, he bought everything that he imagined that he needed. And then after he bought everything that he imagined he needed, he reached the point where he was no longer happy. Because he realized that those things that he bought gave him pleasure. They pleased him. They were pleasing, but they were momentary. And so he would buy something, or he would eat something, or he would travel somewhere. And as he said, once you climb enough mountains, when you get to the top, the view is always the same. And he's at this point in his life now where he's going, okay, I thought I was buying happiness, but I was actually just buying these little moments of pleasure. Mm-hmm. And then once I figured out all I'm doing is buying pleasure for myself, and how momentary that is, how transitory, like, a, you know, again, vanity of vanities kind of thing. This guy sounds like the writer of Ecclesiastes. He sounds like Kohelet. He said now what he's looking for, what he's searching for, is the deeper meaning of life, the universe and everything. It's not about happiness. Happiness is subjective. It's not about pleasure. That's momentary and it doesn't last. So what is it really that's going to satisfy him? And this is a guy, like I said, he doesn't ever have to worry about money. He doesn't have to ever worry about any material possession whatsoever. And he's well enough known as a person. He can just walk into any building he wants, announce himself, and sit down at a table in a restaurant. He can walk into any private club on earth. It doesn't matter. And so now he's asking the bigger question. What really satisfies a human being? And at least for him, it was not happiness, not pleasure, but really this point. If you work really hard for something and then you put enough money away and then you're able to buy that new truck, for example, and you buy that truck is going to make you happy because you worked hard, you struggled, you sacrificed, you did what you had to do to get that truck, and that truck is going to improve your life. And that's going to give you happiness. But if a meteor hits your truck, you're going to be crushed. You're devastated because you can't just run right back out and buy a new truck. You got to start all over again. So whether you're rich or poor, wealthy or poor, Christian or not Christian, I think that's the thing that is always going on in our, and especially in the United States and North American culture, is we're all looking for happiness because we're told from the moment we're born that we're supposed to be happy. And we can talk about that. And then also almost everything that we go after in this life is so that we can have some kind of pleasure.
Yeah. So these three distinctions, happiness, pleasure, satisfaction, discussing the difference between them, this is good. I think you're right. I think it's a very American thing to find happiness. I mean, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that's
right.
In our founding documents, right? Like, that. This is what life is supposed to be all about. And then you talk about this man who has found all the pleasure he could find, and now he's suddenly looking for the deeper meaning. And So I'd like to add a fourth term to our list here, the term joy, and kind of talk about a little bit what the difference is between joy and happiness, and then talk about Christ and being a Christian and the gospel, and whether or not it's whether or not it's actually the goal of the Christian to be happy and to find happiness, mm-hmm. and if that should right. be the well, goal of the Christian.
Is it even the goal of, like, is it even the goal of a human being? Like,
human
is happiness
beings.
Even guaranteed? Like, when did we come, like you said, it's in our founding documents, which came out of the Enlightenment. It was really an Enlightenment idea that you're supposed to be happy. Like, that's the purpose of life, is to, like, be happy.
Right.
I know growing up in the 70s, that was a huge movement in the 70s where my parents just pushed and pushed and pushed as I was growing up. I don't care what you do, so long as you're happy. But, and I've used this example before, and Gillespie knows where I'm going. My ideal happiness was sex, drugs, and playing in rock bands. Like, the absolute cliche of being a teenager in the 80s and 90s. Sex, drugs, rock and roll.
Except
and
you actually did it.
I actually did it.
It wasn't even a dream. It was the real
and
life.
And it certainly made me happy for a moment.
And you discovered that it... Right.
And then
it gave you a little bit of pleasure.
Well, that's the thing. When you're young, when I first started playing instruments, I was happy because I loved playing instruments. This goes to your joy point, right? That playing instruments really gave me joy. Playing in bands in high school gave me just crazy joy and happiness and pleasure because now you're the center of attention. And then as I got into college, though, and I majored in music and art, then it became like a job. And so it wasn't a joy anymore to play music because it was like my job. That's why I was at college. And playing in bands wasn't a joy anymore because I was doing lots of drugs and drinking. And then the purpose of playing in a band was so that you could, you know, get girls and get booze and get drugs. And like everything flip-flopped. And so rather than the joy of making music, all of a sudden now it was just like chasing that pleasure, chasing the next thing that's going to give you that like 5 minutes of pleasure until... As any addict will say, you got sick and tired of being sick and tired. Like, it was no longer pleasurable and it wasn't joy for sure. It was your job and you weren't getting paid for it. You were just chasing drugs. You were chasing alcohol. You were chasing these things because you couldn't live without them. Like, they became an addiction. They became a form of enslavement. And so you go from joy to enslavement. Very quickly.
Just a question then.
Yeah.
So it's got to be something in us that's a natural inclination to chase happiness, to try to find pleasure.
Yeah.
What should we be chasing if we shouldn't be chasing happiness? I mean, and maybe we should. Maybe there's an extent of this that mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. that is good, right? We
yeah.
shouldn't desire to be miserable. We shouldn't desire to go and lay in the ditch and mm-hmm. die a miserable death.
Well, here's an interesting thing, though, before you go any further. The root of the word miserable, the root of that is mercy. And to be miserable literally means to be able to receive mercy. That's literally what that means. If you say I'm miserable, it literally means I'm ready to receive mercy now. Able to receive mercy. To be miserable means you're able to receive mercy. It's crazy. We kind of lost that definition over time. And this is why I think we get confused when Luther or pre-modern theologians say things like, well, until you're miserable, you'll never be ready to receive Christ in the gospel. And we're like, wait, so I've got to like hate myself before Jesus will talk to me? It's like, no. What they literally meant was until you get to the point where you say, okay, I give up. Like, I give up on myself. I'm a hopeless case. I'm a sinner through and through. Like, whatever you got, God, I'm running the opposite direction. So if you don't step in and do something on my behalf, like, this is never going to happen. Like, salvation is never going to work out. I'm never going to know true love. I'm never going to know faith. I'm never going to know, like, hope. That's misery. Like, to be miserable is literally just to say to God, I got nothing on the table. Like, I got nothing I'm bringing to the table. Like, you got to give me everything or I'm lost. Whereas, again, in the modern sense, when we read misery or miserable, we think, oh, Luther wants us to hate ourselves. He's so anti-happiness. He's so anti-joy. He's such a downer. Lutherans are such downers because they always want to talk about Good Friday. And I was like, no, Good Friday is kind of God's way of going, hey, this is what I'm putting on the table, myself, all of me, as gift. And this brings me to your point, to answer your question, then, is... No, we're not supposed to pursue happiness. We're supposed to be satisfied with what we're given today. I mean, this is Matthew, what, 6 or whatever it is, where Jesus says, you know, 6:34, that tomorrow is enough to worry about for itself. And so it's today. We're given today, which is very Old Testament-y, that, and again, this goes into addiction, is picked up on this too, and recovery is, yet there's no such thing as yesterday. As you know, yesterday is not a reality. It's an idea. And tomorrow doesn't exist because God hasn't, it's not created. You literally are given today by God. You're given the sun, the grass, the wind, your job, your vocations, your family, or whatever you're given today is in fact all you have been given. And you can either say, that's enough, it's enough, and receive it all as a gift from God's fatherly hand, like James 1 says, or you pursue happiness, you pursue what makes, you know, gives you pleasure, you pursue something that's going to satisfy whatever you feel is like empty inside of you, or aching inside of you, or pained inside of you, which is why, you know, there are more people addicted to prescription medication now than all the other drugs combined, because everybody's seeking a way to escape having to deal with pain. That's right, as Kate shakes her pain meds.
As I shake my hydrocodone. Okay, so tell me this then, because I've been taught in my life, and I actually think this is a good thing. Certainly there are things in life that it is good to work towards, to desire, to seek after. Mm-hmm. So how do we, you know, especially the person who maybe isn't miserable, hasn't struggled with some of the worst things that life can mm-hmm. give you. It's just living life, going to church, enjoying, you know, their friends, and they've got a family, and things are going pretty well. And they're mm-hmm. thinking about, you know, how are we going to provide for our kids' college? How are we going to provide, you know, how are we going to be able to pay the house off? These things. And so they plan ahead. So how do we reconcile these two ideas of, we're not going to worry about tomorrow. We're not going to, it's not that we're anxious, but at the same time, we certainly are going to be wise and prudent mm-hmm. and plan.
Right.
So how do you reconcile those two?
Well, again, this goes to the point at the end of James's letter, actually, that Jews were saying, you know, we're going to go to such and such a city, we're going to start a business, in the next year we're going to make our fortune, and then we're going to come home. And James actually calls them foolish for doing that, for thinking that they have any control over tomorrow, let alone the entire year. And that, again, everything that they're given is given to them by God as gift, and so they receive it all as gift. And so if you want to go into another country, you want to start a business, you want to make your fortune, that's fine. Make that plan. Go do it. But understand, you have no control over any of that, ultimately. That all is gift from God. And therefore, if God determines, that's not where I want you, that's not what you're going to do, I want you over here doing this, that's what you're going to do. This is the, you know, the kind of Jonah principle also. That Jonah's like, I'm going that way. And God's like, no, you're going this way. Or Abraham, you know, Abraham's like, hey, let's go to Nineveh. And God's like, yeah, no, you're going to go into the salt flats down to Canaan, because I need you in Canaan. I don't need you in Nineveh. And so I think it's, you know, and as my adoptive mother, my Mexican mom, from my time as a missionary, you know, she says, live like it's the Passover in Exodus, that you're packed, you're ready to go at any moment when God calls you out of Egypt, but still got to make dinner. And so that's the way that her and my father live is, you know, they don't have a lot of material possessions. They're always ready to go wherever the Lord calls them at any moment. And yet he's a doctor. He teaches at the medical university, and he works at the hospital and the clinic, and she's a sex abuse counselor at the church, and she teaches. And so they're living their lives. They're paying the bills, because that's the vocation God's given them to bear. And yet at the same time, they live as if he's going to call them at any moment to go somewhere else.
Yeah, because that was going to be my next question, is if you live only in the moment, only in today, then mm-hmm. I would say you're going to have some problems down the road. If you're just living, mm-hmm. you know, right here in this moment, who cares about what's going to happen tomorrow? God's going to take care of that. I don't need to worry about mm-hmm. that. Well, pretty soon you're going to run into some problems.
Like what?
But I think there's something deeper.
Like what?
Like
as one who works this program of sobriety by only living one day at a time, I would like to know what I'm missing. Because I don't worry about tomorrow. I don't. I could care less what tomorrow brings.
But you know you'll have a roof over your kid's head tomorrow, right?
I don't know that. I trust that that's true. That's my hope. That's my prayer, is that tomorrow when I wake up, the day that the Lord gives me, whatever that may be, that at the end of the day, there's a roof you know, I'm more specific than that because it may end up being like a car roof or something. So I'm like, I would like the house that I live in, but I also understand that that's not a guarantee.
Okay.
That's, it's never, you know, we like to take for granted that we're safe and that it's always going to be this way until we choose to act differently.
Well, I guess the reason that I was bringing that point up of, mm-hmm. of not necessarily living just for today is actually for the sake of your neighbor or, you know, whoever your neighbor may be. Maybe it's your wife, maybe it's your kids. Mm-hmm. In a way, God is providing for your family mm-hmm. through
Absolutely.
Through you. So you better be mm-hmm. doing your vocation today to make sure exactly. that they're provided for, right? So,
right, which I think I guess, is the key point, though, is that you can only do what you're given by the Lord to do today. You can't do tomorrow's work today, even right. though a lot of us try to. And we sweat it and go, okay, I got to do everything for the entire week today because I got this thing coming up on Wednesday and then I got this other meeting on Thursday morning and then I got the band concert Thursday night and I got to fly there and I got to fly here and I got to do this. It's like, yeah, that's all going to happen or not. And so as one old theologian say, you hold everything in the dead hand of faith. It's all held very loosely in the dead hand of faith. Is again, you know, you're called to preach the gospel here, so you're going to go there and preach the gospel or not. You know, they say, we're going to call you here, you're going to do this, and then you're going to do this, and then you're going to go over here and do this. It's like, okay, sure. And then you prepare. And every day is that day of preparation. So that, like you said, I don't have to prepare for tomorrow because I've spent 10,000 hours preparing for today. And those 10,000 plus hours of preparation have been reading theology, learning the languages, reading the scriptures, translating the scriptures, reading Luther, you know, all that stuff. So that if I'm called today to teach the catechism, I don't need to do preparation to teach the catechism. I can just stand up and do it because I've been doing it every day. And whether, you know, and so that's the thing is whether you're in high school or college or you're an adult, do what you're given to do today and trust that, again, every day that you're given to do that thing, it's going to get actually easier. It really is. It may not seem like it. It may not feel like it. But every day you're doing that, you're living in your vocation, serving your neighbor, you worry less and less about yesterday and tomorrow because you're grounded in, oh, this is my vocation. This is what I do. And so when I get up, I'm going to do this thing again. This is my vocation. Husband, father, pastor, whatever it might be. It's all gift. It's all bonus.
So what happens when you wake up and you have a job to do that day and you aren't prepared for it and you fail miserably mm-hmm. at that job and and it doesn't
like
go well.
Like being a father. I do that
like
every
being
day
a father. Problem. Or like, going to school, you have a test. Or maybe, let's think a little bit broader to, you know, mm-hmm. Not being prepared for your job in general.
Sure.
Which I think my fellow mm-hmm. teachers would sympathize with me every single day. I feel that way. Like, wow, I could have spent another 5 days preparing just for this one day so that it would be better. But I don't have that time.
But now we're back to the whole question of happiness, though. Now we're back to the question of pursuing something. And that's the thing, is that the anxiety comes from, the fear comes from, the blame or the shame or the guilt comes from, this is what I'm given to do today, and this is what I can do today. Now, today may not have been my best, but what does that even mean? Again, these are very American things to talk about, you know, good, better, best, let your good be better and your better be best kind of stuff. You know, the myth of the self-made man and all this nonsense, is that rather than just show up and do your job, we actually have to measure and quantify how well or poorly we've done our job, which again is the way of the law, limits, measures, qualifications, and so forth, conditions, versus, again, your job as teacher is a gift given to you by God. It's vocation. It's a gift.
But and I better do it well, though. I can't not do it well. I can't slack off on it.
Who measures that?
Well, somebody does. You tell me.
Exactly.
Who does measure that?
I don't know.
I'll tell you the first person who measures it. The parents measure mm-hmm. it. What are you doing for my student? What are you doing for my kid? And there's got to be something there that's good, though. I mean, there's got to be something there because otherwise, I mean, how do you measure what your vocation is? How do you measure if you're doing your vocation or not doing your vocation?
Because when I get up in the morning, I'm still a pastor and a father and a husband, and my vocation is given to me. So I wake up and my wife is there. I don't go find her. She has already been provided for me. My children come to find me and put me into my vocation as father. I don't have to go and like be a father. It's just given to me. I don't have to go and try to be a pastor. I'm given to be a pastor. That's my office. And I've been given a congregation who will call, text, email, or stop by and say, I need you to do your vocation. Period.
Oh.
And that's it.
So you have other people who are making sure you're doing your vocation.
Absolutely. You're doing it. Because that's the purpose, though. The whole purpose of vocation is to serve your neighbor.
Okay.
We don't do our vocations for ourselves. I don't need to work.
That sounds an awful lot like measuring whether or not you're doing it, though. Like, if I go and do my job as a teacher and I don't do it well, if I really do a poor job, I'm going to hear about it. And that's a good thing.
Sure, because all vocation is law.
If we didn't hear about it, then we would just be lazy and we would sit there and we wouldn't do anything because we wouldn't have anybody telling us, hey, you better do your job.
Right. It's called being a recalcitrant ass, as the Formula Concord calls us. All vocation is law. There's no gospel in vocation. Even the vocation of preaching the gospel is still a law vocation because I have an office, and the office has responsibilities and obligations that came before me. You know, the office of father and husband had obligations before I walked into that office. And when I walked up to the pulpit with this woman and said, I do, you know, there it is. Okay, now you got obligations. Do it, because if you don't, you broke your contract. Same thing with my kids. There's obligations, responsibilities. There's no law there. This is Moses stuff. I mean, sorry, there's no gospel there. This is Moses stuff. And then it's incidental if I preach the gospel to my wife and my kids because I also happen to be their pastor. But my primary vocation to my wife and my kids as pastor demands that I preach the gospel and minister the sacraments to them. My secondary vocation then is to administer the law. Because you can't rule your house with the gospel. You can't rule your classroom with the gospel. Think about if you forgave your kids in your classroom for acting up. You know, they would string you up. Oh, don't worry, I forgive you. That's good. Take a deep breath. You know, because again, the old Adam left, you know, the old Adam unrestrained is that's chaos. And the old Adam unrestrained is looking for happiness. And according to the law, the, you know, our ideal form of happiness is murder and rape and stealing and lying. Like, those Ten Commandments aren't there just because God was bored. He's like, I wonder what they're going to try and do next. No, God's like, dude, from the very beginning, here's what your heart's set on. Murder, rape, theft, lying, get it, you know, that's it. And oh, by the way, being your own God. And so that's what our vocations are there for. No, I was going to say, I think our vocations, though, if we go run it in the way of Luther and the Lutheran Reformation, the purpose of our vocation is to stop us from pursuing happiness. Because I'll be blunt. I was going to say, I'll be very blunt. I would prefer not to be married. I prefer not to have kids. I prefer not to be a pastor. I want to be free to do whatever I want, whenever I want, wherever I want, with whoever I want. And God said, that's adorable. No.
Right.
Because your neighbor's going to get hurt.
Yeah.
And if you hurt your neighbor, then your neighbor's never going to hear the gospel. And if your neighbor never hears the gospel, there's no love, there's no faith, there's no hope. There's just a crushed old Adam on the ground that's just the like garbage that you left behind as you go pursuing happiness.
That's what I was going to say, is it doesn't sound like pursuing our vocation, doing our vocation day to day, living out what God has given us to do and taking care of the people that God has given to us. It doesn't sound like that's necessarily a happy certainly it should be happy. It can be happy, but it's not, the purpose of it is not happiness, right? I mean, that's not the, and if the law is the thing that's dictating our vocation to us, like you said, there is no gospel in your vocation. The law is not about happiness, right?
Right. Well, if for the gospel to enter into your vocation, God sends a preacher. That's the thing. You know, people are like, no, there's gospel in vocation. No, there's not. Not without a preacher. That's why there's preachers. That's why Augsburg 7 says, it is enough for the unity of the church that the gospel is preached and the sacraments rightly administered. And this is what I want to drive at too. That's what I want to drive at too, though, is that what happens when this ideology, this idealism of happiness and pleasure is not put to death in our vocations, it's not kept in its proper place, which is, life is hostility punctuated by moments of tenderness. That marriage, real honest to God marriage between two sinners, is ongoing hostility punctuated by moments of tenderness. Most of us grow up thinking, no, wait a minute. Marriage is about tenderness that's punctuated by moments of hostility. Like, well, let me break it to you, kids. That's a lie.
Reasons why I am not married.
I was going to say, if you're arguing with your girlfriend or boyfriend, get ready, because that's basically the rest of your life.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. You know,
at a certain point... this is a great message for youth of today who are dating or whatever, and... Or dating.
Or whatever.
Let's just go with dating.
I was going to say, that's a rabbit hole.
Let's
stay with dating. You know, I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to run away when it's not fun anymore. Yeah, I mean, that's what you watch any
TV
show.
You don't make me happy anymore.
That's what it's all about. Like, yeah, this is miserable. I mean, New Girl or what are some of these other like TV shows that are newer today? Mm-hmm. What happens? Yeah. They break up because they find one little thing that upsets them, and they have no concept of you know, marriage. The union between a man and a woman is not about your own personal happiness at all.
Right.
It has nothing to do with that.
And in case you didn't know this, those TV shows and movies aren't real. I don't know if anybody's actually filled anybody in on that yet.
You just
know what?
Broke reality, my heart.
Reality TV isn't real either, by the way. It's scripted. So don't buy into that lie either. No, and I think that goes to the point, though, is that dating is fun until it's not fun anymore. So you break up, you can go find somebody that makes you happy again. Sexual intimacy is pleasurable until you realize that, wait a minute, there's work that also has to go into this relationship, and that getting pleasure from physical or sexual intimacy is not the be-all, end-all of a relationship. It's not.
Oh, and,
it's not the first or the last word.
Right. And the huge last word to a sexual relationship is a child, which is a whole lot of work.
So, right. You want to talk about vocation. Yeah, exactly.
Hand in hand. Right. Yeah.
And so it's, you know, we often think that the end goal of any relationship is happiness or pleasure. And then when we're no longer happy or we don't receive pleasure from the other person, we go, oh, well, there's something wrong with you. Or, you know, it's not me, it's you. Or it's not you, it's me. Or this is just isn't working out. It's like, no. You know, when we were first married, a Mexican friend said to us one morning at breakfast, she said, marriage is blessed work, but it's hard work. Mm-hmm. And at the time, because we'd only been married like a year, I was like, that's adorable. You know, sure, okay. And then like 4 years later, I was like, oh my God, she was so right. This is hard work. You have to work at this, because the thing is, unless you're willing to get a divorce or just run away from your spouse, you have to stay and fight. You have to stay and grind. You have to stay and figure out, why is this happening to us? Why are we in conflict? Why are we not getting along? Why are we not talking anymore? Why don't you make me happy? Why am I not pleased with you anymore? Like, those are the actual, that's when you're actually married, is when you have to like address those questions and figure out what's going on. You know, why aren't we the way we were when we dated?
Right.
Same thing happens for pastors, actually. You know, a pastor gets to a church, he's new, he's got that new pastor smell, you know, everybody's, you know, comes and checks him out, and we call it the honeymoon period for that reason. You know, you have your honeymoon, sometimes it's 3 months, sometimes it's 6 months, sometimes it's a year or two, but eventually the honeymoon's over, and that's when everybody at church goes, oh, you're just a guy, like the last guy, and they go home, and they stop listening to you, and if you stick around, though, and again, you pray, and you wait, sometimes they come back, and then they learn to enjoy you as a pastor, not as a man, not as a personality, but just as the pastor. And then the relationship between pastor and congregation actually begins. And that's why a lot of guys only spend 2 or 3 years in a congregation and then they jump, because once the honeymoon is over and they crash, they're like, oh, this congregation, they don't listen. They don't want to be you know, they don't want to be faithful. They don't want to listen. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to hear about Jesus. They don't want the gospel. They just want X, Y, and Z. It's like, no, you haven't stood there long enough and fought long enough and worked hard enough to see that there's weeds in the garden. You know, there's rodents that get into the garden that eat the vegetables. There's sun and there's drought and there's periods of famine. There's lots of things that happen in the garden of the Lord. And you're not called to make it rain or make them grow. You're called to just tend to the garden. And sometimes that means you just pull weeds for a long time. And it's not fun. It's not fun at all. But that's how God actually puts you to death, so that he can raise you to new life in Christ.
Right.
You know, and just think about your church and think about what happens at church when we start talking about, well, pastor doesn't make me happy anymore. Or, you know what? I just don't, I don't get anything out of church anymore, which is just a fancy way to go, it doesn't please me. It doesn't tickle my taste buds anymore, you know?
Yeah, there's no pleasure.
That ideology gets into it. Yeah, there's no pleasure for me anymore. The hymns don't please me, or the sermon doesn't please me, or the people behind me in the pew don't please me, or whatever. It's right. Like, you're not, like, church isn't about being pleasured. That's gross. And it's not about happiness. It's about satisfaction. It's about, you know, hearing the gospel and going, that's enough. It's about receiving the body and blood and going, that's enough. And then going home and enjoying your vocation and going, yeah, vocation's a lot of work. And I'm not happy a lot of times in my vocation, or I am, or I experience moments of joy in my vocation, or I don't. It's hard work being single, being married, dating, not dating. Yeah, because you're a sinner and you're not happy with God because he hasn't given you everything you wanted for Christmas.
So let's talk a little bit more about the satisfaction then that we receive at church.
Can't get
from
no.
From our pastor.
Can't, right. That's a Rolling Stones reference, kids. Look it up.
and maybe also the satisfaction that we should get from our vocation and from doing our vocation.
Right.
Because it is a gift. And since mm-hmm. it's a gift from God, it is something to be satisfied with. And not satisfied in this mm-hmm. modern sense of, you know, oh, okay, I guess I can accept that. But actual mm-hmm. satisfaction of this has been what I need. I have mm-hmm. enough. I have exactly what I need, and I'm content with that. Right. And actually being at peace with it instead of this constant nagging to have more, have more, have more. Mm-hmm. There should be that satisfaction there. But at the same time, the old Adam in us certainly is constantly struggling against this. I mean, if we were satisfied, absolutely. If we were actually content, you know, the devil would have nothing else to do with us. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
Well, even Luther had to address this in the 1500s. He writes to he was talking to a pig farmer who was complaining about the fact that God made him a pig farmer. And why didn't God make him a king? And Luther, you know, very, you know, again, very pastorally and very just intelligently goes, dude, you're a pig farmer. You have like two problems. A king has hundreds of problems. He's like, what you don't understand is that when God gives a man the vocation of king, with that vocation comes the problems of everybody in his kingdom. Like, he's responsible for everybody, including you, the pig farmer. Like, he's responsible, and that means that the temptations are 100 times more. The temptation to sin is greater. The attacks of the devil are greater. Like, everything is magnified like 1,000,000,000 times because he's the king. You're a pig farmer. You have one job. Take care of pigs. Now, without you taking care of those pigs, this kingdom will die. Like, it will fall, and the king will have no kingdom because there's nothing to eat. There's no pigs. There's no economy. And yet, God has given you a blessed vocation of pig farmer. And with that comes the temptations of a pig farmer and the attacks of the devil on a pig farmer and the trials and the crosses of a pig farmer, which are few, because Christ has blessed you with that gift that you suffer a little bit. But to the gift of the king, Christ has laid on him an immense burden that very few people could possibly bear without snapping. And when you fall, pig farmer, you fall in the mud. When the king falls, he falls from his throne all the way down into hell. And so be thankful that God made you a pig farmer, because your vocation is a blessing, you know. And thank God every night when you go to bed that you're not the king, because you wouldn't know a moment's peace. You know, but all you do is you look at the king, you look at Bill Gates, you look at the person that you idolize and go, why can't I be more like him or her? If I was like that, if I had that, I know what I'd do. But that's all you see that's portrayed in the media. It's all you see them portraying themselves to be. You see them on the beach or on the mountaintop. You see them with all these rock stars or famous people at these parties. You see them in these, you know, luxury yachts or whatever it might be. But what you don't see is that they have 7 or 8 jobs. What you don't see is there's literally thousands of people who are like depending on them for their jobs. What you don't see behind the scenes is that they're addicted to painkillers, or that they've had their third divorce, or that they can't even remember where their kids are because they were never a father or mother, whatever it might be. And even when they are doing their job and they are living in their vocations, like Bill and Melinda Gates and the Gates Foundation, they travel all over the world trying to, you know, cure malaria and whatever. Like, think about that. Like, whole countries are dependent upon them. That's crazy. think about the amount of responsibilities that, that Bill Gates carries on his shoulders every day. Like, there's whole countries of people who are like, if you don't get us that malaria medicine, our children will die. Like, whole generations will cease to exist if you don't follow through on your promise. Whereas if I say to someone, I promise I'll be there for coffee on Saturday, if I don't show up for that, well, they're just, you know, they're out a free cup of coffee. No one's going to die. And so, yeah, it'd be great to have Bill Gates' money, but do I really want the responsibility that comes with all that money? You know, the fact that he never enjoys a moment of freedom because he has to have security around him at all times? And his children will never know freedom because people want to kidnap them because their dad's Bill Gates? I mean, just all the things that you never think about because you just go, I want that. If I had that, I'd be happy. If I had like a piece of that, I'd be happy.
Yeah.
And yet nobody wants to work for just their paycheck. No one wants to just be happy with the food that's on the table.
Right.
Because it's never enough.
Everybody's working for the weekend.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody. TGIF. You know, we drove by a TGIF, you know, and my daughter, 10-year-old daughter, is like, what's that mean? I'm like, thank God it's Friday. And she's like, that makes no sense. It's like, good for you, honey.
Yeah, that's wisdom. There you go. All right. Excellent. But so focus on your own vocation and too, I mean, this, we might go even to a book of, you know, like Job or something in the Bible where God tells Job, hey, you weren't there at creation. You don't know what I'm doing. And so we can think of somebody like Bill Gates. We can go through that whole thought process of how terrible it must be for him to have all this money and have all this responsibility. Think of the other 7 billion people on the planet. Like, you can't even think through all the other struggles that all these other people are going through. God knows them. God's taking care of them. And in the same way, God's taking care of you. You better be doing, you know, you better just stick to what you've been given to do. Right. That's enough. Yeah.
And the key thing to remember is that the whole reason you're given a vocation is so that God can kill the old Adam so the new man in Christ might rise day by day to live before him and walk before him in righteousness, innocence, and blessedness, like the Catechism teaches. That you're not suffering in your vocation because God, you know, gets his jollies off of watching you struggle. But like Paul says, to live is Christ and to die is gain. And we always overlook the fact that to live as Christ means we're going to suffer, we're going to be attacked by the devil, we're going to be tempted, people are going to reject us, simply for the fact that we're Christians, that we're baptized, but that all of that is because you are a Christian. All of that is because your sinful flesh, the world, and the devil are fighting against Jesus. And that in your vocation, then, the struggle, the pain, the hurt, the joys, the happiness, the sad, you know, those moments of pleasure, all of that that happens within your vocation is God separating you from the old Adam, putting the old Adam to death so that you can be with Christ. And so even in the midst of the struggle, even when you say, this is really hard work and I don't really see the point of any of this, the point is Christ. And that's why the gospel is there for you. That's why the sacraments are there for you. So that when in your vocation you fall, you stumble, you give in to temptation, you sin, you don't sin, you resist temptation, you fight the devil, you are overcome by the devil, you always can run to the Lord's table and you can always call your pastor to have him preach the gospel to you, because that's why he's there. And that's the purpose of your vocation. The purpose of your vocation, ultimately, is to lead you to Christ so that you can receive the comfort of the gospel, the consolation of the gospel, and to eat and drink his body and blood for the salvation of your soul.
Amen.
All right. So thank you for listening to this podcast. That was actually a straight line tonight. We didn't meander too far, except for the tiger thing. So we thank you for listening. Come back next week for a brand new podcast. We love you, as always, and we appreciate your patronage. And may our Lord Jesus Christ bless and keep you in his baptismal grace today and forever.
Amen.
Kate, thank you. Just remember, kids, when the apocalypse comes, Texas. Tigers,
Texas.
Guns, trucks.
It's so hot down there.
Just saying. Just saying.
But they have tigers.
See ya!